Grade 7 Conference, Lecture 41, The Renaissance, Part 6, Continuation of the Life and Work of Giotto. Before Giotto, and going as far as the time of Cimabue, we see the Byzantine tradition, as I mentioned earlier, which is hieratic in nature, which is to say it has a priestly quality. We are seeing images which are, as it were, on waxen seals, impressed with the signet ring of the spiritual world. So we see Mary with the same face again and again, with the same clothes, holding the child in the same way. We see one or another series of saints around her, usually below her, showing that she is in the world of the spirit. They are still more connected to the earth. And we see Mary and Jesus also arrayed with a panoply of angelic figures around them. Nobody smiles. Nobody seems dismayed or distressed either. There is a kind of stone-faced quality because these are imperturbable beings. They live in eternity. And here we are seeing these idealized images. So that's one aspect of that style, which Giotto was to change. Another is the flatness of the image. That great medieval art is almost always two-dimensional in nature. There's the barest suggestion of three-dimensionality, of actual folds of cloth, of actual tendrils of hair. Everything is flattened out and stylized. Now, there are different aspects of this. One is that, yes, very likely, artists were not seeing perspective in the way we see it now. And here again, Steiner says a very dramatic change in consciousness was necessary, which would not happen for another century, before people started to understand what it meant to see in perspective. We might say that the structure of the eye, the organ of the eye, the EYE, was changing along with the structure of the I, the ego. Giotto was one of the first to be able not to formulate this in a quantitative mathematical way, but clearly to be experiencing a world of three dimensions. We see the gold background again and again in medieval art. And Giotto was to pull away from this. Now, here again, it's not to say, well, that made him a better artist. It's different. He was a different artist. Steiner tells us that if we look into the etheric world, it is completely two-dimensional, that we don't see in three dimensions except where the astral meets the physical world. So these artists were working out of a very high level of spiritual perception. They were really looking into the etheric world, but that vision was so powerful that we might say that it obscured for them the physical world, the world of the senses. And Giotto raised up these sentient soul forces, and instead of pressing them down under the beauty and majesty of hieratic images, he began to raise them up to introduce the power and the drama of earthly images. And we'll see some of this work, but I want to bring your attention to one of the great frescoes in this chapel in Assisi. And this is an early scene in Francis's life. You may recall this when you taught it in second grade. Maybe you brought Francis again in grade 6. As you may recall, Francis decided to devote his life to the church and to repair the terrible crumbling chapel in his city. And to do this, he waited until his father, the fabric merchant, was out of town, and Francis basically took his entire inventory and sold it, and with the funds began the work of building the chapel. And when his father returned home and discovered this, Francis said to him, almost like a harbinger of the consciousness soul, well, you know, I'm doing the work of God, and the fabric belongs to God, and I am there, you know, I'm serving God. And his father said furiously, you belong to me. Everything that you are and that you own is mine, including the very clothing you're wearing, you ingrate. And Francis said, almost presaging the 20th century, as a good teenager, well, if it's yours, then take it. And he ripped off his clothing. Fortunately, the bishop in the town was nearby, and out of concern for modesty, he wrapped his cloak around Francis quickly. But Francis had stood for a moment naked before God and man. And Giotto paints this scene, and it's quite remarkable because, among other things, this is the first time that an unclothed or nearly unclothed image of the human being has appeared in European art for hundreds and hundreds of years, not since Roman times. You know, the Middle Ages, everything was covered, not necessarily because of repression and inhibition, but because they understood that the human being had many layers of soul which veiled the body. Giotto had to strip that off, as St. Francis had to do it a century before. That had to be removed so that an entirely new relationship to that physical body and to the higher members around it could be found. So this is a very important moment in European artistic history. And it's hard not to believe that Giotto was the one responsible for that and a number of other remarkable scenes. I'll have more to say when we look at the slideshow. By the beginning of the 14th century, Giotto's reputation was widespread enough that he was commissioned to do a very large project, and this was to paint the interior, again, of a new building, or at least a building that was being restored, called the Scrovegni Chapel in Padua. And Scrovegni was a man who had been, or continued to be, a banker of sorts, a money lender, and there were many grumblings of people who knew him that the interest that he charged was really tantamount to usury, which was prohibited by the church and yet tolerated, because now the need for money to flow and for capital to be utilized was becoming more and more evident. But nonetheless, he undoubtedly felt a measure of guilt about this, and perhaps rebuilding this chapel, restoring it, as St. Francis had done years before with his chapel, this would help Scrovegni overcome his guilt. And he asked Giotto to come and to emblazon it with stories of the Holy Family. And the overall theme was to be salvation, which perhaps Scrovegni felt he needed. It also was called the Arena Chapel because it was located not far from an old Roman arena, which was in complete ruin by then. So in his work, Giotto painted 37 separate scenes, and they're arranged in three levels on the walls. Now, we think, well, how wonderful, you have all this blank space and you could just paint away. As you'll see when we have a slide of the interior of the chapel, his work was not that easy at all. The idea of painting on the walls was not the idea that the original architects of most of these buildings had in mind. So the walls are often horribly arranged, and you have light from a window pouring in, blocking your view of some of the most beautiful paintings. And painters had to get up on the oddest kinds of scaffolds. Certainly Michelangelo had that situation many years later. But it was altogether difficult business, and often there was dampness coming through the stones, and you never knew if the fresco was going to dry quickly enough or if it was going to dry too soon. It was rigorous, almost athletic work. And to see what Giotto was able to squeeze into these odd spaces and the harmoniousness of these various compositions, quite a remarkable endeavor. And certainly up till that time, the most remarkable interior paintings that had ever been seen. So now there's a different orientation. Little by little, or actually fast by fast, stained glass windows are no longer going to be the main source of color, illumination, and even education for people who came to the churches. The stained glass windows are starting to withdraw, to return into the heights of the spiritual world, and now it's the frescoes which are going to be giving the big picture. In glass, it's very difficult to convey something three-dimensional. In a fresco, you're making steps towards doing that. So this was considered to be, in his lifetime and since as well, Giotto's greatest achievement, this Arena Chapel group of frescoes. We will see some of them. And I should mention here again, the theme was a little bit unusual, not only because it had this overriding theme of salvation, that had been, things like that had been done before on a smaller scale, but because in this group of frescoes, though Jesus was certainly very present, there was a very great emphasis on the figure of Mother Mary, of the Virgin Mary, and of the Holy Family, and the flight to Egypt, the slaughter of the innocents. Remember, it was Saint Francis who, not that long before, had developed the whole idea of the nativity and the creche and had presented that for the first time. And these frescoes went on in that spirit. The importance of the Holy Family, of the Mother, the family. Remember what I said about the powerful influence, the growing influence, the advent now of the Archangel Gabriel, who stresses completely on this aspect of human life. Indeed, the art critic John Ruskin was to say many years later, writing in Victorian England, that when Giotto pictures the Holy Family of the Virgin Mary and Joseph and Jesus, he said, when you see them in Giotto's hands, you're really seeing Mama and Papa and Baby, because he humanized them. These are figures with real faces, sometimes looking as much like Italian peasants as they do like ethereal denizens of the spiritual world. They are weighty. They are clearly at times being pulled down by gravity. They have to work to assert their uprightness, to rise up. And we see also on their faces human expression. We see beings who are really living and breathing. And this was astonishing for Giotto's contemporaries to see the spiritual world embodied in a completely new way, to see the sanctity, the holiness of the human being in a physical body raised up to the level of the holiness of spiritual beings. So Giotto doesn't pull his human figures up to the heavens and elongate them and flatten them out. Rather, he draws spiritual beings down to earth and fills them up and truly embodies them, incarnates them in a very remarkable way. So this is definitely his very great achievement in art. As a kind of foundation, he's sort of doing the masonry work, the foundation building for the Renaissance that was to come. Let me conclude by sharing two more anecdotes, stories about Giotto. Well, maybe three. One story is that he was hard at work in his studio, or else perhaps even in the Arena Chapel, working on his frescoes. The Pope himself had heard about Giotto's incredible achievements and was wondering if perhaps he might patronize Giotto and give him some work to do in Rome. So he sent an emissary to go to Giotto and get a sample of his work, some small drawing or perhaps a little painting that could be brought back to His Holiness. And Giotto said, "I'm just too busy. I'm at work here. I don't have the time to do that. Please, please, something, anything. His Holiness won't let me back if I don't come with something to show him." So Giotto said, "All right, watch what I'm going to do." He took his brush, dipped it in red paint, got a piece of board that already had been gessoed so that it was a medium for painting. He anchored his elbow in the middle of the board, and then with little effort and no hesitation, he inscribed a perfect circle without using any instrument but his own arm. "Bring that to His Holiness," said Giotto. Well, the emissary was in terror. Was he being ridiculed? Would the Pope be furious that he had left Giotto and only gotten this much from him? But quite the opposite. The Pope saw the work that Giotto had done, and he knew here was an artist among artists, and he gave him some work to do. Another story is that one of Giotto's good friends, one of the poets or writers of that time, visited him. And Giotto himself, it is said, was almost dwarfish. It's said he was only 4 feet tall. Well, he certainly was short. There seems to be a lot of evidence of that. Maybe that's a bit exaggerated. And the wife that he married was quite plain-looking herself. So this friend, probably the poet Boccaccio, was visiting Giotto in his studio. And for the first time, he saw Giotto's children. And he looked at them and he said, "My God, how can a painter like you, who paints Mary and others with such beauty, how can you have produced three such homely children?" To which Giotto replied without missing a beat, "Well, I made them in the dark." Okay, you may not want to share that one with your seventh graders, but the third one isn't just an anecdote, it's something very true, that just as there's a lot of controversy over where Giotto was actually born and when, and with whom he actually studied painting and when and how and why, there's also even controversy about the circumstances of his death and where he was buried. So, the belief is a particular chapel in Italy, and there were hot contesting about it back and forth, and finally the bones were dug up, and this is the description of what was found. This is in the 1970s. The bones were found not far from the spot that Vasari identified. So they decided that they would get forensic studies done. An anthropologist was brought in, and it turned out that these were indeed the bones of a very short man, just a little over 4 feet tall, who may have suffered from a form of congenital dwarfism. It's even said that there's a self-portrait of Giotto that he did picturing himself as a dwarf. And they also found in the bones there was a range of chemicals, including arsenic and lead, which were used in the paints of that time, and that an artist would have absorbed after a long use into his entire system, including right into the substance of his bones. And also the teeth were pressed out in such a way that suggested someone who was holding something like a paintbrush in his teeth while he worked perhaps with another brush. So of course, there are just as many forensic investigators who say this is ridiculous and, they're grasping at straws. But there you have it. The very bones defy complete identification. And why not? We feel that someone like Giotto was not yet fully a man of the earth. As earthy as his figures were, he still belonged as much to the heavens. The consciousness soul had not yet come, which really put people firmly into the field of gravity. So Giotto is the beginning of the Renaissance and perhaps the last tender farewell to the Middle Ages.